the hallmark of non-convulsive status is altered mental status. And so how many times our hospitals, our ICUs, our floor patients may be in an altered mental state, and we haven't quite figured out why are they like that. And it's interesting in the studies that have looked at altered mental status patients in ICUs that a large many of them are in fact in non-convulsive status epilepticus.
Welcome to Up My Nursing Game. I am your host, Annie Fulton. This is an educational nursing podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls, all while offering free CE credit through VCU Health for each episode. I wanted to start off by saying a big thank you to all of you who completed my listener survey. I learned a lot about my listeners, and I'm confident that what I learned will help me produce episodes that are more tailored to your needs. So again, thank you for the valuable input. All right, so I had the awesome opportunity last week to go to the American Association of Critical Nurses NTI conference in Houston. And if you don't know anything about NTI, I like to call it like the Lollapalooza of nursing conferences. It was huge. And honestly, it was my first ever nursing conference. And I can't believe I've gone through, 8 years of being a nurse without going to a nursing conference. But I highly suggest going to any nursing conference if you ever have the chance. It was really energizing to be able to step away from the grind of bedside nursing and have a chance to reflect on my career, reflect on what's happened over the last 2+ years, and learn about the latest and greatest in critical care nursing. I got to see one of Nicole Kupchick's 16 presentations. Dear God, 16 presentations in 4 days. I don't know how she did it, but she is such an authority in the critical care world, speaking on topics such as hemodynamic monitoring and my new obsession, capnography. All these topics are available on her website, and check out the link in this episode's show notes. For the next few episodes, I will be interviewing nurses who spoke at NTI. These are really the movers and shakers of nursing in the U.S., and it's such a privilege to be able to pick their brains about their specialties, which will range from ARDS to hypoglycemia and nutrition. However, for today's episode, I will interview Mary Kay Bader, who led a fascinating session about seizures. I had a listener request for an episode about seizures, and I think it's a fantastic idea because what the heck do we do if our patients start seizing? We know to, turn our patients on our sides, don't stick anything in their mouths, and administer lorazepam. But Mary Kay did a wonderful job of really fleshing out the rest of this scenario and brought up a topic that I hadn't thought of, non-convulsant seizures. So just to brush up a little bit on seizures, there are two broad categories of seizures, the first being generalized and the other being focal, which in focal used to be called partial seizures. So generalized seizures affect both parts of the brains, while focal seizures only affect one part of the brain. So today's discussion will focus on generalized seizures, which can further be broken down into two subcategories of convulsant and non-convulsant. And if you're like me, you're a little fuzzy on what exactly the dangers of seizing are. And I'll tell you, it's brain damage, more specifically, seizure-induced neuronal death. This is generally not a concern for isolated seizures that are short in duration, but for seizures that last over 5 minutes. And what's important to know is that status epilepticus, meaning a seizure lasting over 5 minutes, is that it kills neurons and leads to chronic epilepsy. Okay, I think that's enough background about seizures. Listen in. All right. Welcome, Mary Kay Bader. She's a nurse working as a clinical nurse specialist.
That's correct.
Correct. In a neuro ICU. What hospital are you at now?
I'm at Providence Mission Hospital in Mission Viejo, California. It's located in South Orange County.
Fellow Californian yes. here. That's great. And she just gave a talk at NTI where we are right now. So your talk today was about generalized tonic-clonic seizures. And seizures, like a lot of neurology topics, are something that I have a lot of phobia over as a nurse, right? Like, there's lots of shades of gray. It's not highly measurable, unlike cardiology, where everything is very, like, engineered and mathematical. So for me, seizures have always been a point of uncertainty and concern for me, and something that I've been worried that would happen, you know, on a shift of mine, that a patient would seize and I wouldn't know what to do mm-hmm. about it. So I was really excited to see that you were presenting on seizures today. Before we actually jump into that, let's just talk a little bit about your background and how you became this clinical nurse specialist in neurology.
Sure. So I've been a clinical nurse specialist since 1991, but I've been a nurse for 44 years. So I wow. started in general med surg, but then moved into critical care in 1981, was a bedside nurse, a trauma nurse. I did a clinical educator role. And then once I became a clinical nurse specialist, I've focused my specialty in neuro and in ICU. So that's my background. I've worked at Providence Mission Hospital for the last 25 years, work with the team of physicians and nurses and therapists, and build evidence-based protocols, also algorithms that's easy for the nurses to be able to translate, you know, sometimes very complicated care into more of an understandable approach and how you manage specific disease processes. Do a lot of teaching, engaging family support and family-centered care, and also, you know, a little bit of research and quality work. But the primary focus of my role, I do clinical rounds every day, but it's bringing to the bedside that latest evidence that's being published and how we can translate that into care at the bedside with the entire team, and not just nurses, but how the team communicates and how we actualize that research to our patient populations.
And is your work specifically in the ICU? Are you also taking that out to like the acute care or even the outpatient setting?
Right. So many of the classes that I teach, the nurses from, for instance, the stroke unit may attend, or the cardiac telemetry unit, or even the cardiac ICU. I, you know, have a few other specialties, post-cardiac arrest care. I chair the resuscitation committee. I also teach for the emergency department nurses. I'm the clinical expert and liaison for our rapid response team. So I developed that. So just being very involved really across the entire hospital and having the ability to teach and to influence and collaborate with nurses and physicians from all the different specialties, which makes, you know, it's one of the things that I enjoy so much in my position.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds really exciting to me, especially as someone who really values, you know, the other members of our healthcare team. I really enjoy like that collaboration expert, like just working well together as a team with physicians and nurses and physical therapists. They're right. a huge part of neuro.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Speech language pathology, oh, speech occupation. Language. They're like my best friends.
Right.
And it's so important. when you take care of a patient who has some type of neurological disorder, neurosurgical disorder, it takes a village. It takes a multidisciplinary team to bring that patient back from their illness or their injury back into the community, and extends, you know, you want them to get back into their life, right? To go back to work or to back to school. And it's only going to be possible with the work of not just the team in the ICU, but the team on the floor and then the rehab team, which
Absolutely.
Are they're amazing in
Absolutely.
What they can do.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So, you know, before we jump into this discussion, I wanted to just really define terms here. So today you spoke about generalized tonic-clonic seizures. And how would you define that kind of in your own words?
Sure. So a seizure is a disruption in the neurochemicals in the brain, basically, where there's becomes an imbalance and a patient can sustain a motor phenomenon or a tonic-clonic phenomenon. Sometimes a seizure starts very locally, a focal area in the brain, and then it can spread and generalize to both hemispheres, or sometimes it just starts in a generalized seizure. And so, you know, we've always learned that, you know, you have to protect the patient from injury and a seizure, but there's so many other elements. And if a seizure continues and lasts more than 5 minutes, that now becomes status epilepticus. And there are two terms related to status epilepticus. There's convulsive status epilepticus, where you visibly see hands and legs and the jerking kind of motion. It's a very visual thing that you can watch. Mm-hmm. And then there's something also called non-convulsive status epilepticus, where the brain as a whole is seizing. You just don't see any motor phenomena. Maybe you see a little, what they call automatisms, a little twitching around the eyes, or a little twitching around the mouth, but the hallmark of non-convulsive status is altered mental status. And so how many times our hospitals, our ICUs, our floor patients may be in an altered mental state, and we haven't quite figured out why are they like that. And it's interesting in the studies that have looked at altered mental status patients in ICUs that many of them are, in fact, in non-convulsive status epilepticus.
Wow.
So understanding and recognizing a seizure and, of course, calling for help right away and getting the things, you know, we're going to protect the patient. We're going to observe them. Are they demonstrating? How did the seizure start? Was it both arms and both legs, or did it start on one side of the body and did it spread to the other parts of the body? That's important information to relay to the providers who are going to be looking to see, well, was this a focal seizure that secondarily generalized and spread throughout the whole, you know, both sides of the brain? How long did the seizure last? We've been all trained about some of the particulars like that, but also at the same time, protecting the patient from injury. And then assessing and reassessing airway, breathing, circulation. So how are they oxygenating? How are they ventilating? If a seizure goes on for more than 5 minutes, or let's say someone has a seizure and then the movements that you saw stop, maybe you gave lorazepam, a medication that's a benzodiazepine, and you get 4 milligrams and the seizure stops, but they haven't returned to their baseline. They haven't come back to what they were like before the seizure. They could, in fact, you know, they may have another seizure, or they could be in non-convulsive status epilepticus. So although you may not see the motor phenomenon, if their mental status has not come back to what it was before the seizure, their brain could still be seizing. And the danger with that is that when a brain is disrupted in this excitatory state, there's all sorts of neurochemicals that are changing, and it's consuming oxygen and glucose, and it, within about, you know, if this continues on for a period of time, by the time 30 minutes has elapsed, then the brain is now going to sustain significant injury and perhaps permanent injury on a cellular level. The neurons are going to be damaged because of this sustained seizure activity. And we don't want that to happen. We want to get as early on as possible, recognizing it, treating it, stopping it, so that, you know, they can work on, well, what medications might they need to prevent this from happening again.
Let's go back to this non-convulsant seizure, mm-hmm. which for me is very scary,
yes.
because I can't see it. I don't have that clear visual presentation of a seizure.
Right.
And you talked about presentations like altered mental status, like kind of a twitching of mm-hmm. the face. Like, could you just elaborate on some presentations that you've seen before to kind of paint like a good picture of mm-hmm. what nurses should be looking out for?
So sometimes we've had patients who are on your unit, and maybe they came in with a diagnosis of stroke, or maybe they had a traumatic brain injury. Maybe they have a tumor in their brain, some type of pathology. And when you're assessing them and reassessing them, I've seen something as simple as a person who was admitted, who was answering questions appropriately, and then the next morning you go to ask her a question and she answered everything with 99. Well, where are you from? 99. What day of the week is it? 99. And that was the only thing she could say. And so we're making rounds. The neuro provider or neurointensivist was there. He goes, let's get an EEG on as fast as possible. And sure enough, she had an element of seizure activity. Sometimes you'll come across a patient that maybe you took care of all day and the patient's just been altered. And you get in report, well, they're altered. They have altered mental status. But if you're truly aware and looking and assessing your patients and you see those twitches that happen in the face, you know, you have to think to yourself, is it possible that they're experiencing some type of non-convulsive status epilepticus? And the only way to truly know is to get an EEG on the patient. So that just like for heart nurses who know that if there's a cardiac event, right, you have a patient who is having heart abnormal beats, like their pulse is irregular. Well, you don't really know the rhythm until you put an EKG on them, right? Are they in atrial fibrillation? Are they just having PACs? Are they having some kind of abnormal heart rhythm? Well, the way you identify it is through an EKG. But in the brain, the way you identify it is doing an EEG. I mean, you can do a CT, you can do an MRI, and that's going to show you lesions and things like that. But it's not going to show, we can't say, oh, they're having a seizure just from looking at an MRI or CT scan. So EEG monitoring is important. It needs to be done as fast as possible to diagnose and then to really, as you're administering the medications, finding out the right medicines that stop it and then keep it stopped. Sometimes we put patients on continuous medications that will stop their seizure. And then the minute we start lightening that drug, such as propofol or midazolam or ketamine, you'll see the seizures come back. Mm. So really EEG monitoring is the only way to truly know. I think our knowledge of non-convulsive status has increased dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years. Mm. So as we're rounding in the ICU on a daily basis, something happened last week. I just had to chuckle. One of the neurosurgeons was sitting at the desk and he was entering things into the computer. And he looks up, he goes, I don't ever remember seeing so many EEGs on patients in my career. And there was like 9 patients in our 20-bed surgical trauma neuro ICU had continuous EEG monitoring on. I said, well, that's because we didn't recognize that they were having seizures in their altered mental state. And he's like, huh.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think it's just an awareness of recognizing. You see altered mental status or confusion, you say, oh, yeah, they're confused. But why are they confused?
Right.
What's the cause of the confusion or what's the real cause for the altered mental status? We all know that we look at glucose, we look at sodium, right?
Right. That's what I was going to say. Like I could explain it away with, you know, electrolyte abnormalities, low blood sugar, metabolic disturbances. Like, yes. You know, I would probably ask for an EBG way before I would ask for an EEG.
That's correct.
And I think for me, like the diagnosis of seizure is so low on my little mm-hmm. nursing differential mm-hmm. that I'm so glad to like be able to speak with you today and kind of gain awareness and insight on, you know, keeping that a little bit higher up on our, you know, the forefront of our brains when we're dealing with these altered patients.
And I think when you have the experience of working with neurologists who specialize in epilepsy, so an epileptologist, he's the one that Dr. Parshar Dhouris is our epileptologist at Mission Hospital. He's our medical director of neurology. And he would say to me, he's been there now, I think 4 years, but he would say, Seizures are a true neurological emergency. Why don't people respond rapidly when someone's having a seizure? Why don't they understand how important it is? Yes. And it made me think, like, you know, he's right. When we have a patient that has a cardiac arrest, what do? They go into ventricular fibrillation. We don't sit there and go, oh, look. Yeah, they're in VFib. No, we call a code. Right.
We have a big old blue button in the room, and then we have about 30 people enter within a minute.
Yes, and we're all doing simultaneous things to get that patient's pulse back, and we're looking at the rhythm. Yet, we have a patient who has a seizure. Like, maybe one other person shows up to help you out, and then you give a medication, the seizure stops, and then they're like, okay, seizure stopped. Well, in fact, if that patient doesn't immediately wake up, the seizure could be continuing. They could be in non-convulsive status after the convulsive status epilepsy, right? They had this episode. So they could still be seizing. And so we need to evaluate. We need to put the EEG on as fast as possible and then make sure we're giving them the right medications to stop the seizure.
Absolutely. In your La La Mary Kay Bader land, what would it look like when a patient has a seizure in a hospital? What I wanted to ask is, you know, you were describing a code blue, right? And as far as I know, I don't know of any hospital that has a code seizure.
And maybe we should.
And maybe we should. That could be a future NTI session. No, like in your ideal world, what interventions would be done?
So I see when a patient has a seizure, getting, you know, 5 to 6 people at the bedside immediately, and we're going to be doing simultaneous thing. One nurse is going to be observing the patient clinically. How is this seizure? How does it progress? How long is it lasting? You know, does it stop and then start again? A nurse and respiratory therapist are going to be up at that airway, right? Airway and breathing. Because if the seizure doesn't stop after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, we're going to have to probably intubate them and put them on a ventilator to make sure we can oxygenate and ventilate. You need somebody who's going to put, if they're not on telemetry, getting them on either telemetry or the bedside monitor, because the medications we're going to give them to stop the seizure, some of those medications affect heart rhythm, right? Because all the anti-seizure meds that we have at our disposal, some target sodium channels, some target other aspects like GABA receptors. So you need to make sure that we have all the monitoring tools on, which means EKG, we're going to check their blood pressure. Somebody's going to do a finger stick, right? What's their glucose? Because you can have a seizure with just hypoglycemia. Mm-hmm. So and they're probably going to be drawing labs, right, to send off. Like, is there something going on with their sodium? Is their sodium 110? And that's why they've had this seizure. And then your providers are going to be there and they're, you know, trying to think about, you know, what's brought this seizure on, what caused it. But more importantly, you know, your EEG that needs to get on within about 15 minutes. So, you know, do you have EEG techs readily available or do you happen to have a system? Like we have what's called a rapid response EEG, which is just a headband EEG that we put on the patient. And within 4 minutes, we're able to see if this patient's in fact seizing. So we can guide our treatment to what's going on inside the brain.
I could definitely see the benefit of having this rapid response EEG because I could see where you take a patient who has been in a convulsant seizure into a non-convulsant seizure, but you don't necessarily have that feedback that patient has gotten out of a seizure.
Right. And that's validation. Like you gave lorazepam a couple times and maybe the doctors ordered some Keppra. So you're giving the Keppra and then you see a change in the EEG. And although that's a neurologist or an epileptologist who interprets EEGs, there are ways with certain technology to measure a seizure by listening. So there's, you know, one system that has what auscultation of what they call it a brain stethoscope, and it changes EEG to sound. And so you can detect the seizure. The nurse can detect the seizure with the sound. And then the system we use, the rapid response EEG, which has artificial intelligence built in. So by the time 5 minutes of monitoring has commenced, it's able to give you a seizure burden. So the percent of time that the brain has been seizing in the last 5 minutes. So, which is important, right? Because you want to recognize status epilepticus and you want to stop it or with the right medications as soon as possible. The earlier you treat patients, the better they're going to respond to those drugs, because drugs like benzodiazepines, our lorazepam, our midazolam, our diazepam, those drugs become less effective once you're 2 hours. By 2 hours, the efficacy has dropped dramatically.
Yeah. So let's talk about medications a little bit. The one that comes to mind for me from nursing school is lorazepam. Have there been any changes to medications in the last few years?
So as far as the benzodiazepines, your lorazepam, I think the one common mistake that occurs is that the provider may order 1 milligram of lorazepam. Now, 1 milligram is not going to do anything. that's not going to stop the seizure. So some neurologists will say, well, if you're really worried, let's say you're on the floor, right? Your patient's not intubated, they're not on a ventilator. The minimum amount is 2 milligrams that you could give, but ideally what's in the guidelines for status epilepticus is 4 milligrams given over 2 minutes. So if you have an IV, but then when you give a 4 milligram dose, you have to monitor the oxygen saturation, right? You got to make sure your patient's breathing okay. So are they moving air in and out? And then looking at your, you know, your blood pressure and things like that. So lorazepam should be given in 4 milligram doses, but 2 milligrams may be okay, especially if you're on the floor, like a med-surg unit, and you're a little concerned about whether they continue to breathe and is it going to affect it. But I think the number one mistake that's made is too low of a dose that's given to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. I could also see how the situation would arise where a patient wouldn't have IV access. Let's mm-hmm. say if they had a very violent seizure and right. they lost IV access. What do you do in those circumstances?
So the studies have shown that midazolam can be given effectively intramuscularly, intranasally, mm-hmm. right? So you can give it that way. And then diazepam, a lot of the pre-hospital care providers will give diazepam rectally, especially out in the field. You know, they're in the home environment, wherever they be, and maybe in someone, even like a young child having a seizure, they would administer rectal diazepam.
Okay.
And it's been effective in stopping it. So if you don't have IV access.
Okay. So it sounds like benzodiazepines are really the mainstay for
stopping the seizure.
For stopping the seizure. Yes. Yes, thank you. And then what medications would you expect a provider to order once that seizure has stopped?
So they'll generally order a type of anticonvulsant or a medication, something like when I first graduated from nursing school, phenytoin dilantin. That's what we would give patients. And then fosphenytoin came out, which is very similar to dilantin. And then now with the last decade, levetiracetam, which is Keppra, that has just overtaken, I think, all of our patients, even prophylaxis, you know, for, you know, they come in with a traumatic brain injury, or they've come in, they've had maybe one seizure in the ER, and they'll put them on Keppra. And Keppra
absolutely.
Really is, I think, the drug of choice that we're seeing
That's
in
what I'm
hospitals.
Seeing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There are other, if that doesn't do the trick, like if they've loaded, given an appropriate loading dose and they're optimized the medication, if that doesn't stop the seizure, they'll start to add other medications, valproate, they could. There are drugs that target specific neurochemicals, you know, the sodium blockers, so lamotrigine, lacosamide, those are the same category as phenytoin and dilantin. It's in that same group that targets the sodium channels to kind of quiet it down. So the whole goal when you're trying to stop seizures and make them not happen as readily is to basically decrease the excitatory action of the cells and to increase the inhibitory so that they're less likely to propagate a seizure, that electrical signal.
Got it. That makes sense. Does the medication that's chosen for the seizure prevention depend on the cause of the seizure? For example, I'm thinking like low blood sugar could cause a seizure. On the other hand, they have epilepsy.
Epilepsy is the diagnosis and management of epilepsy is very specific. And really the neurologist or epileptologist is going to look at, you know, when they load them on a certain medication, are they having breakthrough seizures, and what they try to optimize that medication to the therapeutic drug level. But sometimes they have to add a second drug or a third drug to get full control, to diminish it so they don't have any seizures at all. So it just depends on the individual, where the focus of the seizure is coming from. And if it continues to be very irritating to the brain, leading to, you know, full-blown tonic-clonic seizures. So it's a very complex, complicated, I'm like, wow. But you can see their thought patterns, like, well, they're still having seizures on Keppra, so let's add lacosamide. So they will, depending on their experience and what medications are available on the formulary, they will add certain meds to get control. But let's say that you've given a patient lorazepam and tried to stop the seizure, and that didn't work. And you gave them Keppra, and you loaded them with Keppra, and they optimized their dosing, and they try another anti-convulsant drug. They may, you know, at this point, if your patient's still having breakthrough seizures or not awake, they may have to intubate them and put them on what we call third line medications for refractory status epilepticus. And that's where you start to see drugs like propofol and midazolam and ketamine, pentobarbital, that are used in continuous doses administration to get the seizure activity to stop. And that can be difficult. Once in a while, I think the, you know, maybe once or twice a year, you'll have a patient called super refractory status epilepticus, where even, you know,
you're just throwing the kitchen sink at them.
You have them on four continuous, they're on propofol, midazolam, ketamine, and pentobarb. They're on six anticonvulsants. And anytime you would drop one of those meds, they go right back up into it. The last person we had, I think he was 45 days on those medications. But he actually was able to finally get weaned off and through, you know, went to rehab and recovery. But that was a, you know, and he was a young guy, like 26 years old.
Yeah.
But they were able to get him through it.
Wow.
So that's why really those types of cases need to be dealt with at a tertiary critical care unit that really specializes in epilepsy or seizure management.
Absolutely. I was just wondering, like, patients who have epilepsy, mm-hmm. are they given lorazepam to give at home, like, or midazolam? How are they trained to deal with?
So the family members, yeah. So the family members are trained on, you know, first off, how to keep them safe if they do have a seizure, you know, the positioning and making sure that there's no injury. Some may have, like, maybe rectal diazepam that they could give, right? Because they're not going to have an IV sitting at home.
Right.
So I think when they learn to live with epilepsy, the caregiver knows what it is that they need to do, and they've been given instruction on how to administer something like diazepam if the seizure does start. So it just depends on, you know, how well the caregivers at home are able to assist and manage the epilepsy.
Yeah. I was on a bike ride a few years ago, and the gentleman before me all of a sudden just started to ride right in the middle of the road. And I was thinking, oh, is he just being like ostentatious, or I don't know what's going on. But then he eventually just rode off the road. Mm-hmm. And I looked down, we were on a hill, and I looked down at him and I saw him convulsing. Mm-hmm. My nursing brain thought, I need lorazepam, and I am right now, but I don't have one. And his dad later came and said, oh, he does this. He seizes.
Oh.
And in my mind, I was like, what is he doing on a bicycle?
He had
a helmet, but what if, I mean, what's a helmet going to do if you you crash into a car? And
did they have some kind of seizure kit?
No, he just said it will resolve.
Oh.
It will resolve.
Okay.
And it did, but I was thinking, I have such a range of emotions, from scared to mad to feeling bad for him. Because if you have a seizure disorder, it means, like, if you're, I don't know, if you have a very high potential for having a seizure, you can't drive.
Right.
You can't ride a bike. You, I don't know, if you're a parent, I imagine that, you know, it wouldn't mm-hmm. be a good idea for you to take care of your kids by yourself. Yeah. And it gave me an appreciation for how difficult that disease mm-hmm. could be.
Right, right. And in the hospital, right, we don't have seizure carts, right? We have crash carts for cardiac arrest. But there's no seizure carts or seizure bags that have all those medicines there, the medications that we need to administer rapidly. But it's something I think we should think about, you know, having that ability.
I had that thought when you were, you know, reviewing the medications. Like, are these on our crash carts? Like, is there rectal midazolam?
No, I would say no. I know it's not on my crash cart, but, and it's because a lot of those medications are controlled substances, right? So they have to be locked up. Mm-hmm. So whether or not you could have something in your Pyxis, for instance, that was like a seizure kit of some sort would be helpful. Our rapid response nurses at our hospital function under a standardized procedure in the state of California. You can write standardized procedures that allow you know, based on a certain clinical condition for the nursing, the specialized nurse who's been trained and educated and you've evaluated competency to be able to administer the medications. Of course, you always call the physician, the provider, to say, I'm in this situation, the patient's seizing, but, you know, they know to, you know, put the EEG device on to obtain lorazepam out of the Pyxis as fast as possible to administer it. Because the priority is the patient, right, and the patient's safety. But you also want to do it in a safe way, one that protects you and the patient, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I like the idea of a seizure card.
I know, you shouldn't. Come up with something.
Yeah.
And market it.
Yeah. That'll be your business venture. Well, are there any like takeaways you would like listeners to have?
I think asking the question when you are taking care of your patient, you notice that they're different, they're altered. You know, why are they altered? Is there a good reason why they have this altered level of consciousness or altered mental status? Because it doesn't just have to be a patient with a neurologic disorder. It could be a patient with sepsis, severe sepsis, or a septic shock. We see that's a very big high-risk group where seizures can be occurring and non-convulsive seizures could be occurring. And it's probably the last thing that people might think about, that, oh, the reason my patient's not interactive and the reason they're altered is, well, I don't know, it's because they've been in the hospital and it's ICU delirium or hospital delirium. Well, these are patients that are laying in beds in our hospitals. And so it's the awareness that non-convulsive status occurs. I think everyone recognizes a tonic-clonic seizure.
Like, right.
All of us can pick that out. But early on thinking, is this a possibility that my patient may have altered mental status due to non-convulsive status epilepticus? As we raise that question, it's got to be in that differential of altered mental status. And the faster we can identify it and treat it and break it, then the better the chances are that person's going to have of having a normal outcome, right? And not have any kind of injury to their brain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think my takeaway would be that the EEG is really the EKG of the brain.
Yes, it is.
And that I'm not seeing enough of them.
Yes. And I think it's probably because if you think about all of our hospitals, they all have crash carts, right? We have, in my hospital, 34 crash carts. And we have a monitor, a defibrillator monitor on every one of those crash carts, don't we? There's $25,000 of defibrillators sitting on 30 crash carts in our hospital, right? You think about, well, Habermed, they cost a lot of money.
I'm sure they're very expensive.
Yeah. So think about how many EEG machines we have in our hospital. You know, is it, do you have 3? Do you have 9? Do you have, and how accessible is that?
It's not accessible. And I'll tell you, because I used to work on an observation floor and we had patients who came in with TIA and, you know, EEG was often part of the order set. And we would keep patients overnight. We keep them maybe even 2 days because we had EEG techs only available on these like banker hours,
right,
so to speak,
right,
and in stat circumstances.
Right. And so there's that delay to applying it and a delay in diagnosis. But if I just think hospitals, and we all need to be more attuned to the need for urgent, emergent EEG monitoring. And that's a really important tool that, you know, I think our hospitals have to invest in the technology to give our patients the right care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I could see one barrier to that would be that it's very time consuming to put on EEGs. I mean, how many?
Oh, those little electrodes. There's different montages, as they call them, but you know, it requires a skilled EEG tech to be able to set it up, and it often takes them 30 to 45 minutes to apply all the leads in the position. Whereas some of these portable monitors, these EEG what I call this rapid response EEG device, it takes 4 minutes to put it on. It's a headband. You fix it in the front. You turn the little knobs 5 to 7 times and then eject the gel, and you're ready to go. Hook it up, and via Wi-Fi, the signal is transmitted. So even if your neurologist or epileptologist is in their office or at home, they can just get into a computer, into the HIPAA-provided website, and look at the EEG.
Wow. I mean, that sounds like the future.
Yes.
Right there, is in these rapid response EEGs. Well, thank you so much, Mary Kay, for being here today and for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
For the invitation. Hopefully this will increase awareness.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, that's it for me. Thank you for listening. If you feel that this podcast has added value to you in your career, please share it with your nursing friends and colleagues. Claim your free CE credit through VCU Health by going to the link in the show notes. All right, that's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.